Tonight on Arena, Olivia Lang on The Silver Book, The Second Coming of David Bowie, and from First Fortnight, He Dies at the End. You're very welcome along to Tuesday night's Arena. The numbers stay the same. You can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32. You can email arena at rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at rte underscore arena. When David Bowie died 10 years ago this month, the world of music lost one of its brightest stars. A trailblazing artist who blazed so dazzlingly in his life on Earth that the loss for so many was one they still haven't come to terms with. And the books, the documentaries and the elegies keep coming even today. January is an important month for Bowie fans. 50 years ago this month, he released Station to Station, and it's also the month that he released his final album, Black Star. It was the month of his birth in Brixton, as well as the month of his death in New York, 2 days after his 69th birthday on January the 10th, 2016. However, there was a point in his career when he wasn't turning everything into gold, where the career was a little washed up and he couldn't quite get back on track. A documentary and a book called Lazarus, The Second Coming of David Bowie by Alexander Larman both explore this period of Bowie's career where he couldn't quite grasp his genius, and the book then details his gradual creative rebirth. Joining me now is music journalist Pat Carty, who's been reading the book and watching the Channel 4 documentary that was shown on Sunday night called Bowie, The Final Act. Pat, you are a major fan.
Yeah, I would be. Since I was about, I would have been about 12 maybe around when Let's Dance was a big hit. So I was just kind of starting to pay attention, do you know what I mean, to music in general, and certainly to someone as just cool as that. Because you talk about that period, right? Now, I think, obviously I didn't know this at the time, but I think from about 1969, about Space Oddity, up until and including Let's Dance, some people don't, I think he just didn't put a foot wrong at all. In fact, I think it's probably the greatest artistic purple patch that anybody has had, to carry it on for that long, to be able to take all those left turns and bring his audience with him. And he just seemed to, so prescient, he just seemed to just have, be in touch with, he just seemed to be hip in a way that other people never were. And he could sing. And he could write these great songs.
And in a way that was so radically different to pretty much everybody else at the time as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, he takes stuff like his great left turn, say, after Diamond Dogs, I'm thinking, right? Diamond Dogs is kind of, is still glam, you know, he's killed off Ziggy a couple of years earlier, but there's Aladdin Sane in Diamond Dogs, and they're still kind of, you know, rock and roll albums. There's a touch of the Stones about them, there's a touch of Ziggy about them. And then suddenly he's making Young Americans. You know, and of course, that time, as I've spoken to people, I wasn't really conscious at the time, but I've spoken to other people who were fans at the time. You didn't hear all about everything he was doing on the internet. So suddenly, a single like Young Americans was released, and you go, that's nothing like what we had 6 months ago. And of course, artists work harder that time. They were putting out an album every year at least. And then, you know, he takes soul music back to Europe with Station to Station, which you mentioned there, which is probably my favourite of the whole lot of them. And then he goes to Berlin and starts making stuff like Low, half its instrumental, with Brian Eno, Heroes, Lodger. Scary Monsters invents kind of new romanticism and industrial rock almost. And then he decides he's going to have a couple of hits with Let's Dance. It's incredible, really. But things start to go wrong, of course, after Let's Dance. That's the problem.
They have to at some point. Yeah. Look, I'm going to start with one of the tributes to him. It was the documentary on Channel 4 on Sunday evening. Is there much more to be said about him that hasn't already been said in documentaries like this?
Well, I really enjoyed that documentary. I mean, I'm not sure Larman's book is associated with it or not. I'm not, they may be two different entities entirely. I'm not sure about that. But they cover the same period. So they cover, as you said, quite rightly said, Bowie's slow kind of road back to artistic recovery, for want of a better phrase. You know, just so they both start at the end of the 80s. So what they've done is they've skipped over the absolutely terrible period in the middle of the 80s. So you have Tonight comes out a year after Let's Dance, and it's not great. You know, there's a couple of good songs on it, but it's not great. He covers God Only Knows by the Beach Boys on it. What was he thinking? I don't know. And you thought that was bad. But then in 1987, he puts out a thing called Never Let Me Down. The irony of that title is not lost on anybody. And it's atrocious. It's a terrible record. And I, you know, some people might be sitting at home going, oh, no, I love that record. Well, fair enough, but it's really, really bad. And but Every Cloud, he did get to play in Ireland the first time on the tour, and I did go to see him. But that wasn't great either. That was Slane. That was one of my first ever concerts, full stop. Wasn't great because it was the Glass Spider tour and it was on in broad daylight. So you were looking at this fiberglass spider where Bowie came down from the ceiling on a barber's chair and all these dancers, but it didn't really work in the daylight. And he was hawking that dud album as well. So he was closer, as I say in next Sunday's paper, to Phil Collins than Philip Glass at this stage. And so it was a long road back.
Did it take you a while to come up with that, or you've
been, I have a file at home, Rick, with all that kind of stuff.
The new biography, the book that you've read, Lazarus, so it focuses on that least successful period.
Yeah.
So tell us about that period and about what goes on in that.
Okay, well, in 89, and Bowie realised himself, and you can hear him in the documentary say, like, you know, I didn't really know where I fitted in anymore or anything like that. You know, he's very conscious that he was crap at the time. And I suppose as a kind of a way back, he surrounded him, he put himself into a band rather than standing in front of it. So this is the infamous Tin Machine that he formed with a fellow called Reeves Gabrels and the Hunt Brothers, who had played on Iggy Pop's albums in the 70s that Bowie had produced. And their first album came out in 1989. Now, I can very clearly remember buying the cassette of that and putting it in my Walkman back in 1989 and walking along down in Offaly and thinking, ah, this is more like it. A lot of people really hate that first album, including Mr. Larman, who absolutely slates it. And the reviews that Bowie was getting, it's very heavy, kind of hard rock almost. And the reviews at the time, there's one in particular, and this is in the documentary as well, the guy who wrote it is in the documentary, from the Melody Maker. And I won't read the whole thing out because there's a lot of swearing in it, but it basically says, sit down, you're embarrassing. And they say in the documentary, one of Bowie's press people, that they saw him reading, I don't know if this is true, they saw him reading it and he was in tears and everything. I find that a bit hard to believe that David Bowie at that stage would take a review that seriously, but maybe he did because he was kind of lost. The one thing I would say about the documentary, I'm sorry to keep banging on here, Rick, but there's a song on the album called I Can't Read. And this story I didn't know. And the chorus of it goes, and I'm sorry to get a bit blue here, I can't read shit anymore. Okay, he says that in the chorus. But what your man Gabrels was saying, the guitar player was saying, well, what he's actually singing sometimes is like, I can't reach it anymore. So he was aware that he wasn't the same, you know, godhead that he was before.
I'm going to play some Tin Machine.
Great.
Maybe for people who've never heard Tin Machine before, this is a track called Under the God. Okay, that's Bowie and Tin Machine from the Tin Machine period. That's called Under the God. You're tapping your feet.
People can go down secondhand record shops tomorrow and get a copy of that. They won't find my copy of it there, though, because I'm keeping that, but I like that record.
Is there a suggestion in either the documentary or the book as to why he went through this patch, the kind of runs he fell off the rails?
No, there's no explanation for it, really. He just, it happens to every artist. I think every artist has a great purple patch. Like, take someone like Prince, for example, who was untouchable in the 80s. And then he made some bad records later on. Rolling Stones had a great period. You know, all these people, they have the Beatles were different, I suppose, because they stopped before they got bad. But you know what I mean? They all have this period. Now, his, as I say, was longer than most people's. You got to think of it from being David Bowie, you know. That must be hard to cope with. that you're so far ahead of everyone else and everybody is praising you, you know, for 10 or 15 years, and suddenly people are telling you to sit down and things like that. So maybe he was crying when that press officer saw him.
You mentioned about seeing Bowie on the Wogan show on the BBC, and he wasn't at his best that night.
Yeah, well, the thing was with Tin Machine, because he very much bought into this thing, we're a band. We're not David Bowie and Tin Machine, we're Tin Machine. So each time he was interviewed, he insisted that the band were interviewed together. So they were on Wogan playing a song from their second album, which Larman thinks is better than the first one, but I'd put them the other way around. I don't think the second one is much good. But there's a song on it called You Belong in Rock and Roll. It was a single. And they Wogan, as people remember, used to have, it was 3 or 4 nights a week? Mm. It was like the arena of television. It used to be on 3 or 4 nights a week. And so they went on and mimed this, and then Wogan walks over. The clip is in the documentary as well. Wogan walks over and he has a chat with him. And Bowie is obviously bored and a bit cynical. And what Wogan says, basically, I can't find it here. Oh, I can. He says, Wogan would later say, and Wogan, as people know, seemed like a very reasonable, you know, nice bloke. He would later say that this was the most difficult interview he ever encountered. And he thought a solid slap would have helped the situation. You know, but he, as he says then, but I didn't hit him, of course, but it came close.
There's a picture to put in our heads for a Tuesday.
That'd be great television. Bowie and Wogan wrestling.
When does that fallow period then end for him?
Well, it takes a while. You know, he meets his wife, Iman, in 1990. So obviously life is getting better for him. There's a side note here where Larman says that he bought a £2 million Irish estate. Now, I can find no evidence of that. I found a thing in the Irish Independent about him being interested in Humewood Castle in Wicklow, but he never got the checkbook out, as far as I know. But anyway, some of the music he used for their wedding formed the basis of their next album, Black Tie, White Noise, which was where he called Nile Rodgers back in. Nile Rodgers had produced Let's Dance, which had been such a commercial success. Now, I'd agree with Larman here. It's a very patchy record that they end up with. It's a thing called Black Tie, White Noise. But, you know, it's a step in the right direction. The best story that comes out of it, I think, is the fact that he covers a Morrissey song on it. He covers a song called I Know It's Gonna Happen Someday, which is originally on a Morrissey album called Your Arsenal. And Your Arsenal was produced by Mick Ronson, who was Bowie's lieutenant back in the day. And it's a kind of a torch song, but it does take the chord sequence from Rock and Roll Suicide at the end. And so Bowie took it back and covered it again. Now, there's a whole more stuff about the relationship of Morrissey and Bowie that I can go ahead that goes through to later on.
I'm going to ask you about that in a second, but yeah. I do want to play something from the Black Tie, White Noise album. This is a song called Jump, They Say.
The shaking man, a nation in his eyes, striped with blood and emblazed tattoo, streaking cathedral spire. They say, they say, they say, he has no brain. They say, he has no moon. They say, he was born again, they say. Look at him flying, they say. Jump. They say, jump.
That's David Bowie. That's Jump, They Say. Tell me about Morrissey and about the relationship you had with him.
No, sorry, I was just dancing to Jump, They Say. I just remembering that from a long time ago. Yeah, Bowie and Morrissey were going to have this kind of strange relationship after that song that he covered. And he asked Morrissey to support him on a tour later on, the tour around the Outside album. And Morrissey did it for a while, but he wasn't enjoying himself. He wasn't, as Larman says, he wasn't born to play a supporting role. And he dropped out in the middle of the tour. And this was something, you know, without much warning. And this was something Bowie wouldn't forget. So years later, on an album, they actually recorded a song together as well. They recorded a version of Cosmic Dancer by T-Rex, I think, around that time, and released it together. It wasn't very good. Anyway, later on, there's an album called The Next Day. This is much later on with Bowie. And there's a song on it called You Feel So Lonely You Could Die, which is the best song on it. Larman says that, and I agree with him on that one as much as that. And he's really taking direct swings at Morrissey there. And that there's callbacks to the music of both those, of that song I mentioned. But also he says, this is the lyrics now, I can see you as a corpse hanging from a beam. I can read you like a book. I can feel you falling. I hear you moaning in a room. Oh, see if I care. Oh, please, please make it soon. You know, so he just held on to that grudge, you know. But it's just fair enough. You know, Morrissey's pretty good, but I mean, David Bowie is David Bowie. Yeah.
I'm going to skip forward a little bit to 1999. I want to play this before I talk about his relationship with the early internet. This is David Bowie in what has since become a legendary interview with Jeremy Paxman.
But what is it specifically about the internet? I mean, anybody can say anything. And it all adds up to what? I mean, it seems to me there's nothing cohesive about it in the way that there was something cohesive about the youth revolution in music.
Oh, but absolutely. And because I think that we, at the time, up until at least the mid-70s, really felt that we were still living under the... in the guise of a single and absolute created society, where there were known truths and known lies, and there was no kind of duplicity or pluralism about the things that we believed in. That started to break down rapidly in the 70s, and the idea of a duality in the way that we live, in there are always two, three, four, five sides to every question, that this singularity disappeared. And that, I believe, has produced such a medium as the internet, which absolutely establishes and shows us that we are living in total fragmentation. I don't think we've even seen the tip of the iceberg. I think the potential of what the internet is going to do to society, both good and bad, is unimaginable. I think we're actually on the cusp of something exhilarating and terrifying.
It's just a tool, though, isn't it?
No, it's not. No. No, it's an alien life form.
What do you think, I mean, when you think then about the
future... Is there life on Mars? Yes, it's just landed here.
But that's yeah. It's simply a different delivery system there. You're arguing about something more profound.
Oh, yeah, I'm talking about the actual context and the state of content is going to be so different to anything that we can really envisage at the moment, where the interplay between the user and the provider will be so in simpatico. It's going to crush our ideas of what mediums are all about.
It's an extraordinary exchange from 26 years ago. That's Jeremy Paxman and David Bowie. I do have to skip forward. I want to talk about the final album, about Black Star, released on his 69th birthday in 2016. The album is widely seen as being one of his best.
Yeah, it was this book. This book had convinced me that it's good. I when it came out, because it came out 2 days, as you said, it came out 2 days before he passed away. And like all Bowie fans, I went out and bought it and we were listening to it and still absorbing it when the news broke that he died. So at that point, you're listening to everything by him. And maybe I put it away on the shelf, and maybe I was sick of everybody telling me how great it was. I didn't really get it, or maybe I just needed some distance from it. But reading this book and Larman's convincing argument that it is a late masterpiece, because, and also watching, say, the videos again that went along with it, the single Lazarus, where there's an incredible bit. You know, it's all about his, he's facing up, he knew he was dying, and it's facing up, and it's an artistic a duet. He writes his own requiem, and but the video for Lazarus, where there's one scene in it where he's shaken and he backs into a closet / casket, which is an amazing thing for an artist to do. And he reestablished himself at that stage. You know, we don't have time, but he went through, you know, he disappeared for 10 years when he had a heart problem and all this kind of thing, and you know, his albums got better and better, but the last one really is, of all of the ones that are in this period, it's the one you could definitely say, yeah, that stands up to the earlier stuff.
Then let's play Lazarus.
Thank you. I've got scars that can't be seen. I've got drama, can't be stolen. Everybody knows me now.
David Bowie from the final album Black Star. That's Lazarus. Just to finish, Pat, would you recommend the book?
Yeah, I would absolutely. It's the period that most Bowie fans would know the least about. So there's all these great stories in there. The art. I can't even tell you the art fake, the Bowie net, which your man compares to only an early version of OnlyFans. All those albums that you kind of reappraise, and you know, because they're none of them are bad. There is at least two or three songs on each of those records that is definitely, and sometimes more. So you get all these stories, and also the way his demise, his last years, are very well handled. Larman writes for the major papers in England, and has written biographies of Edward VIII and Lord Byron. So he's a new territory here, but he handles it pretty well.
Pat Carty, thanks for joining us. Lazarus, The Second Coming of David Bowie by Alexander Larman is published by New Modern, and the documentary Bowie, The Final Act is available to watch on the Channel 4 website and app. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. Olivia Lang is a writer who has spent their career mapping the intersections of art, bodies and the landscapes we inhabit. We've welcomed them to Arena before to discuss the radical history of the body in everybody, and most recently to walk through the restorative and political soil of the Garden Against Time. But tonight we're turning away from the archives and towards the Dream Factory. Olivia Lang's new novel, The Silver Book, is a feverish cinematic thriller set in the years of lead in 1970s Italy. It's a world of stolen film reels, secret desires, and the looming shadow of the great filmmaker Pier Paolo Pasolini, who it is no spoiler to reveal was brutally murdered in 1975. Olivia has described the process of writing the book as if they were tuning into a radio frequency, taking dictation from the ghosts of the famous Cinecittà studios to create a story that is part noir and part love letter to the handmade illusions of the past. Olivia Lang, you're very welcome back to Arena.
Oh, it's very nice to be back. Hello.
You've described writing this novel as if you had tuned into a radio set of a sort and that you were simply transcribing voices. I'm interested to know what it's like to have a story arrive at you with that level of speed, because this was a very swift project for you.
It wasn't, because I spent a long, long time thinking about it, but I didn't start it until kind of the last minute. So I'd assembled lots of information about Italy in the 70s, about Fellini, about Pasolini. And then I went to Rome and I wrote it incredibly fast in 2 months. And it did feel in a very uncanny way as if I was almost taking dictation. And, you know, I'm really a nonfiction writer and my work is slow and laborious and often extremely boring. And this, by contrast, was fast, exciting and almost eerie sometimes.
In terms of that research, are you somebody who tends to get lost in it, either for your fiction or nonfiction?
I love it. I love plunging into a lost world. And with this one, I had the extra pleasure of being in Rome while I was writing it. So it was almost as if I had this resource to time travel through. I could walk down the same streets that my characters walk down. I could cross the Tiber. And yet all the time I was trying to step back into 1975 instead of 1925.
I've read the entire concept for the book, this initial meeting between the real Danilo Donati and the fictional character Nicholas, that it came to you while you were in a water taxi in Venice. It sounds like a great way to have the inspiration hit you. Can you describe that experience and maybe why Venice was so inspirational?
Yeah, I wanted to write a thriller and I had this idea of a sort of Ripley-esque thriller, but I could never really work out where I wanted to set it. Did I want it to be in England? What country did I want it to be in? What time period did I want it to be in? And at the same time, I'd got very interested in Pasolini's murder, and especially this story around the possibility that some stolen reels from his final film, Salo, were used to lure him to his death. So I was sort of clocking that these reels had come from other films as well, that they were made around the same time and the same people were involved. And this is how I came to Danilo Donati, the magnificent magnificent Italian costume designer. He was a participant in both sets of films from which reels were taken. And I started to realize that he could be the key to my story. And then I was in Venice on a completely different trip. And as I was leaving the city, I really did have a vision of seeing Danilo walk across a square, the Campo Santo Stefano, and see this red-headed English boy sitting on the step drawing, and this massive electric shock happening between these two men that really set the whole story into motion. And I knew immediately then this was the book. I knew it was called The Silver Book. And then I just waited a year kind of thinking about it but not writing until I got to Italy the next year.
I've seen you write as well about some of the research that you did into Danilo Donati himself and about his costumes and about his work and finding access to that.
And that was amazing, because about halfway through the experience of writing, I suddenly realized I needed to physically see the costumes. Obviously, I'd seen them on the internet, I'd seen them in books, and I found out that they were at Sartoria Ferrani, which is still a costume atelier in Rome that makes costume for film, for theatre, for opera, and they still had all of these costumes intact. So I managed, by way of being an Instagram detective, to work out who the person was that we had shared friends, got hold of her, and I was summoned to the atelier and really sat on a chair and interrogated with a translator, why are you interested in our Donati? What do you want to know? And eventually I passed the test, and then they brought out these costumes, they told me stories of his life, and again, it was extremely exciting.
In terms of the backdrop of this novel, it's set in 1970s Italy, and it's been a period of immense political violence at that stage and social upheaval for quite a while. Can you remind us of the political context of the time the novel is set in, and maybe what interested you in that?
Yeah, it's called The Age of Lead, and that's really lead as in terrorism, as in bombs, and there's constant far right and far left bombing campaigns, this sort of rise of fascism, and a real sense that things are unsettled politically, that things are dangerous. And, you know, I think it's probably apparent to every listener that that has echoes and connections to our own time of instability and extremism. So it felt like thinking about that period allowed me to think about our own. And Pasolini is at the centre of this story, and his obsession really was that fascism was on its way back, and it wouldn't look like it had in the Second World War. It would be different. It would be merged with consumerism. It would come with a new face, but it would be violent and terrifying. And again, I think in that prediction, he was right personally. He was killed in a very brutal way, but also I think he was right in terms of our own world.
It makes for an extraordinary backdrop to the other stories, which are those of the making of Casanova and the making of Salo, and in particular Danilo's part in all of this, which is about the physical, tactile craft of 1970s filmmaking.
Absolutely. And I think we could call this an anti-AI novel. This is really my declaration of handmade human art, collaborative art, often anonymous art. You don't necessarily know the name of the costume designer. You certainly don't know the names of all of the people in the costume factory. And yet these people are labouring behind the scenes to create the films that, you know, that we love, that sustain us.
Do you see that kind of filmmaking as being maybe more honest?
I don't know that it's even more honest, because it is absolutely a pursuit of illusion, but I think there's something deeply heartfelt about it. There's something deeply meaningful about it, and I really wanted to celebrate it, almost in a way for a younger reader who might not even be aware that that kind of cinema of paper and scissors really existed.
Or that you might need to recreate the Bridge of Sighs in Venice on a set rather than use the real thing.
Made out of papier-mâché. I mean, these sort of, the sea is made out of plastic bin bags. It's really sort of cheap and on the fly and inventive. And I think that that imaginative elan is so inspiring, I think, where we feel like we're more and more cut off from art and it's more and more to do with computers. It feels very good to me to think about what people can do with their hands.
Well, I haven't seen Casanova in years. It made me want to go back and rewatch it as soon as I can. Tell me about Nicholas Wade. So you have a trio of real people who are here. Nicholas is the character that you've created. He's fictional. Tell us about him, because he does start the book as a bit of a Tom Ripley sort of figure. He's an outsider on the run.
He's absolutely an outsider on the run. And I think when I started writing him, I thought he was going to be a Ripley figure. I thought he was going to be a very cold, potentially quite manipulative, even slightly psychopathic person. And as soon as I started writing it, I realized that I had a very different character on my hands, that he's somebody who is deeply damaged really by homophobia. This is a book about queerness in a very homophobic period. And the big thing that all the men in it are carrying around is their gayness inside a society that detests them. And I think that's the motive for everything that happens. All the tragedies that Nicholas kind of brings into the world happen because of that. So he became a much more appealing character to write. And also, of course, he served as my eyes and ears into this closed Italian world, a world of filmmaking and a world of production that is otherwise entirely Italian. Here's this kid who can explain things, who can ask questions. And so he was very necessary for the clockwork of the book as well.
I think that's an important point. I know I'm paraphrasing here because I don't have the book in front of me, but at one point one of the characters says, "Man has walked on the moon, but I can't walk down the street and hold your hand in daylight."
Absolutely. And that's Nicholas saying that sense of grief and impossibility. And you know, this is only 50 years ago. It's really not so long. And those men's lives were really shaped by that. And that was one of the things that the people at Ferrani really wanted to tell me about Danilo, was how deeply that homophobia had affected him, how that had shaped his life.
In terms of writing real characters in a book like this, people who have really existed, and then inserting a fictional character into that narrative, is that something you've got to be very careful with?
Incredibly careful. And I'm a non-fiction writer. I'm very scrupulous about what I do with real people anyway, and have all kinds of rules for myself. And with this, I really didn't want to make anyone do anything that I didn't think they would have done. And I also initially had thought that I would have Pasolini's actually horribly brutal death visible on the page. And I quickly realized that was something that felt really transgressive and inappropriate. And I've often in nonfiction books talked around the circumstances of people's violent deaths or suicides without actually staging the death scene. And that was something that I did again here, that I didn't want to show him being beaten to death, run over by a car. I wanted to talk about the aftermath and the circumstances.
The plot involves the theft of the film reels from Pasolini's last film, Salo, a film that came out a couple of weeks after he died. Can you tell us a little bit about the film itself? It was immensely controversial. And then how the theft of those reels may have been involved as a lure for his eventual murder.
Yeah, so Salo is a very difficult film. It's Pasolini's version of 120 Days of Sodom by de Sade. And I think what he was trying to do was create a sort of masquerade of fascism, in particular to investigate the victim mindset, the collaborator mindset. He wanted to understand about complicity and compliance, and those were the things that he was really focused on. I think if Pasolini hadn't died, that film might not have been so badly misunderstood, but because he was killed, and killed in such a way that it seemed as if he'd been murdered by a rent boy out looking for sex at night, as he often was, the manner of his death made it seem that that book was, that film was pornographic, exploitative, instead of a masquerade that is really designed to draw attention to something political.
Yeah, for you, you draw this into it. Pasolini is somebody who's a truth teller. He foresees the merger of fascism and capitalism and then oncoming ecological decay as well. I mean, when you look at the world in 2026, not that I'm encouraging you to, but which of those warnings do you think has come home to roost most clearly?
I mean, I think Pasolini was on this a real visionary. I think he really did see something. And in particular, sort of the fusion of capitalism with right-wing ethos, and that would bring with it social decay and ecological decay. He was very emphatic about that in the early 70s in a way that I think has been proven. And I think, you know, there are lots of theories of Pasolini's death, but the one that I find most plausible is that he was murdered for the warnings that he was making. He was very explicit that these were the criticisms he was making. There were people responsible. He knew the names of the people responsible. And I think his death was very much an attempt to silence him in what he was saying.
You've said that non-fiction can't keep up any longer with how strange and fast-moving reality has become. So how does fiction give you a knife or a swiftness that your previous books didn't allow for, maybe?
I think it's more that it lets me go inside as well as outside, that it allows me to report on what's happening inside people's emotional lives, inside their thinking lives, inside their dream lives. And I think there's something about being able to just cut to the heart, to have scene after scene without needing to necessarily explain, give lots of backstory. We're becoming increasingly skilled at reading very compressed narratives. And I think that the novel is adapting and responding to that as well.
At the end of the book, there's a disclaimer about truth. So you've mentioned that after years of nonfiction, it was lovely and liberating to use your imagination, provided you stayed truthful to the facts of the murder. But how difficult is it to define truth in a novel like this versus truth maybe in a nonfiction work like The Lonely City?
In a way, I think this is the closest I could possibly have got, because I think it would have been impossible really to describe that atmosphere of homophobia, that atmosphere of making, without having these as breathing people. So it's a new way around it. And I really try and be as scrupulous as I would be in a nonfiction book, but I feel like what I'm able to make is closer somehow.
Is it a way of reaching a different audience potentially as well, those people who might be far more willing to read a novel than read a non-fiction work on the same subject?
I don't know, because people are constantly changing their ideas of people only read non-fiction, people only read novels, and I feel like whichever book I've just done is the one that people aren't reading anymore.
You're working quite a lot at the moment. I was going to ask you about, you know, imagining going back to the slower, more archival pace of narrative nonfiction, but it seems as if you're constantly working and constantly swapping back and forth.
I think so. And that feels like a really fertile place for me to be. And also to think, what does this project require? Is this a project that I can best be served by nonfiction? There's no way I could have written The Garden Against Time as a novel. It would have made no sense. That had to be a large scale survey of century after century. Whereas this more intimate, more immediate story clearly fits itself much more naturally into fiction than nonfiction.
And can I ask you what you're working on at the moment?
I actually think I'm writing a prequel to The Silver Book, which what we haven't talked about is that Nicholas is escaping from a catastrophic situation in London. And I think the prequel is going to explore that catastrophic situation and really what was happening in London in the 1970s.
It has been fantastic talking to you tonight. Olivia Lang, thanks so much for joining us on Arena.
Thank you so much. Lovely to talk to you.
My thanks to Olivia Lang. Olivia's novel, The Silver Book, is published by Hamish Hamilton and it's out now. I'm dead, but it's not as bad as it sounds. Matty Maguire tells us in the opening moments of the play he dies in the end. Matty's been knocked down by a car and he's thinking back on his life, the romance that's coming to an end, the boss who's driving him crazy and the brother who his dad prefers. The play, written by Liam McCarthy and performed by Darren York, won a first fortnight award during its sold-out run at the Dublin Fringe in September. It returns next week for four performances at the First Fortnight Festival, and Liam McCarthy and Darren York join me now in studio. You're both very welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Liam, I'm going to start with you. I'm going to ask Darren to perform an excerpt from the play in a minute. But first of all, tell us, who is Matty Maguire and where is he and why has he just died?
So Matty Maguire is a young man from Longford originally, living in Dublin. He's a bit of a wannabe writer. That's his kind of quiet dream. And when we join him at the very, very start of the play, he's in the middle of Wexford Street in Dublin city centre. And he's just been involved in an accident with a car.
And that's not a spoiler, because we find that out from literally the first
one. I think the title, he dies in the end. You know,
He's dead from the beginning. Yeah. Just less of a ring to it.
Yeah.
Darren, give us a few lines from the beginning of the play.
On the morning of the night that I died, I got up early. I went to work. I saw my dad. I met Louise and that's it, I suppose. A very average Wednesday on the middle of a very average February ends in catastrophe. for me at least, Wexford Street sometime after 11 on the 12th of February 2025, if that's relevant. A silver car swings, stunned at the near miss with him. I mean, he doesn't notice me. And then blue lights flashing, and then no lights at all. And then I think I died. And it all feels very final. It feels very unfair. It's funny to be talking about your feelings when you're dead. Not to make it all about me now or anything. It's sad, but there you go. Like, that's it, I suppose. Matty Maguire, dead since. Life goes on. Though not for me, obviously. I'm dead. But, I mean, it's not as bad as it sounds. I hadn't much going for myself in the first place.
As you and as that character, and you relive those moments over and over again in a series of loops that happen then all the way throughout the course of the play, is that quite an intense role to play?
Only as intense as my head already is. There's like a glide upwards into it. He starts from a very relatively calm place of just the shock of a death, in the same way that you kind of don't know how to process it immediately when you hear about someone else's death and you sit with that. It's usually at a really inconvenient time, like you're walking the dog and you're like, can't cope with that now, I'll shelf that till later. So it opens with him in that state, and then, I don't know, just leaning into the right, and it naturally ramps up to the point where you don't notice you're at full tilt, and then it just doesn't stop till it's over.
Liam, it's worth stressing here, there is a lot of humour in the play. I mean, Matty does work himself up, for instance, thinking about how his mam will have him decked out in the coffin. Tell me about giving somebody as troubled as Matty that moment of comedy throughout the course of the play, because it's quite dark in its nature.
Yeah, it is. And this is the moment I tell you the play called He Dies in the End is funny. Like, I do think joy, humour, bit of crack is really important in theatre. I think it's a bit underrated, because you can use theatre to kind of subvert expectations and woo them into a false sense of security. Darren is naturally very funny anyway, and real good comic timing as an actor. And we did get a few laughs when we did it in The Fringe. So yeah, it's important that, you know, he doesn't take himself that seriously, and there is moments of flippancy. Like, not to take away from the seriousness of it all. Like, it is, it grapples with serious themes of loss and grief. And, you know, Matty's life is kind of not turning out the way he wants. It's kind of a life falling apart. But at the same time, he's self-deprecating and he's sending himself up, yeah, throughout. So hopefully, yeah, comedy, it's a, for me anyway, it's an important element of the show.
And is it important for you as a performer?
Oh, huge. Yeah, make him laugh, make him cry, make me care. You make people care through humour. And like, the self-deprecating thing, I was talking about this earlier, we just kind of dove back into it today and yesterday, but the self-deprecating thing in an Irish way mostly is so that somebody tells you, ah, no, sure, you're great. And because you're doing this as a monologue to an audience, they don't respond. So he never gets that uplift when he's putting himself down and saying, I'm terrible, I hadn't much going for myself, my family didn't really care about me. All this comes out like in the first couple of pages. There's no response to that. So he said it out loud now, and then he has to sit with this and kind of falls into this spiral of justifying himself, and that's where the retelling comes from. But the self-deprecating, like, we're both very self-deprecating anyway.
Yeah, so. And I think, like, you think about grief and death in Ireland, like, I don't know any wake or funeral that's not hilarious. Like, in terms of my family, and, you know,
laugh a minute.
Yeah, 100%. And like, even today, we did a run for a couple of people that aren't involved in the production, and they started to laugh again, which we'd been missing. Do you know, it's kind of a scene partner. Kind of need those to punctuate it, to tell the story.
What's that like, trying to get a performance like that back up to speed again? Because obviously it's existed last year at The Fringe, and now you're preparing to have it back on stage again and to get back into that headspace.
It was gas. I was like, let's just launch into it. We had a Zoom where I was like, let's just revisit it. And I wanted to see how much of it was already in there before going back to the text. I hate working with paper and words because I see the words on the page in my head. It's more lived in now. So for me, it felt like going back into an empty house and going into every room and trying to remember like what was in the rooms and just like hoping stuff was still there. But coming back to things fresh, having like lived for 4 months since that, but also like haven't had time to let it sit. Things struck me in a way that they hadn't before. Like there's words and lines where I'm like, oh my God, is that what this means? So yeah,
it's a luxury you don't always get as a performer, that ability to come back to a character like that, having you know, maybe not thought about him for months.
Yeah, I think like I came back to him with a lot more. I'm way more defensive of him. There's a lot more compassion for him, and it's this constant thing as well of like, why is he telling us now? Like, why is he choosing to open up about this to? Kind of on like it's he bears all in a really like it's a bare stage and he bears all like it's I've lost my way.
This no, but like I get, but underestimate like the how difficult the piece is. Like you know, just it's essentially there's 6 or 7 scenes and vignettes of the city. He tells a story of his life or the last day of his life again and again and again. And what's hard for us in rehearsal is it's very hard to do anything in isolation.
That's it. Yeah.
You know, because if you do, okay, he crept down the stairs and he got a bowl of this Cheerios or whatever. Yeah. But then
Honey Nut Loops.
Yeah, it's Honey Nut Loops, and it has to be. No, it's not crept down the stairs. Yeah. It's trundled down
he
the stairs
this
because
time,
trundled down the stairs is scene 5, which is different to scene 2 because of this. Yeah. So I'm here going, well, why can't we run scene 2, 5? We actually have to run the whole thing from top to bottom.
And actually just like the taking the words in isolation, like the words don't mean anything. It's the emotional state he's in when he's talking about it at that point, a half an hour in, having told you this version of it just before.
Yeah. And he never lies. Like I was thinking about this on the way and it's like he's an unreliable narrator. But I think an unreliable narrator is someone who kind of presents a version of the truth. He always tells the truth, but he just leaves things out. And then I think the story changes, the narrative, the storytelling changes depending on, well, this piece of information that happened just before is important, but I'm going to leave that out now. And then it slowly comes to realise.
As the writer, Liam, where does Matty come from?
I suppose it was trying to kind of think, okay, things that... there's an underlying, without giving too much of it away, there's an underlying kind of grief and loss that... That Matty is grappling with, so it kind of, you know, which is why it's lovely to be a part of a festival like First Fortnight, which is all about mental health. So that was kind of the impetus or the first kind of crumb in terms of writing the piece. And then I was trying to think about, you know, grief isn't a linear process, it's like a loop-de-loop thing, and how do you create that in kind of a storytelling narrative way? And I said, okay, if you kind of riff on time and potential, because you know what's great about theatre is you can kind of, you know, it has its drawbacks, you know, but at the same time theatre has advantages. Like Darren is just on a stool, and what you can do is kind of really control the order of information and control time. And what's great about theatre is that an audience will accept what you say to them. The first line Darren says is like, you know, I'm dead. And we all accept that straight away.
Immediately.
So,
There's a great scene where Matty meets an editor to talk about the first few chapters of a novel that he's written.
A fan favourite.
Yeah. And she thinks it's about one thing and he thinks it's about another thing. And this is in part a play that's about ways of looking.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's all about perspective. Do you know, as I said, like, you know, the various things happen with his father, with his partner, and at work. But as he presents it in different ways, it's all about, you know, nothing is good or bad. It's just, you know, the way that you look at it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, one way, we were actually talking about this yesterday with our producer, Jenny Little, about like what that scene is about with the editor. And for me, it's like, it just reminds me, and maybe this is the impetus of it, is being reminded of, you know, meetings with directors or dramaturgs and going, what are you actually writing about? So in one way, that meeting is like a catastrophe. But another way, it's just someone who's actually interrogating you and interested in your work. Just depends how you like read it.
Yeah,
it's
your state of mind. Yeah. Going into the conversation, like you don't even know, maybe he was hungry, like it's that kind of thing. Like,
you
just need to have dinner before you meet that person because you're like, your energy is low, so you're spiraling, you're taking everything as an attack.
Yeah.
And then, like, a couple of scenes later, he's looking back at that exact same conversation with completely different takeaway.
Darren, you and Liam have worked together before. Where did that whole collaboration begin?
We started in college. Like, we've just been acting the Aegis in each other's plays for, what is it, 12 years ago? Long time.
Yeah.
But, is it Rhapsody Above Thomastry. Liam wrote a play in college. I was in that. And then I put him in a play that I'd written. And
And we collaborate a lot on work for children.
Yeah.
So weirdly, the last few years, it's mostly been work for children. And this is our first work for adults in a while that we've collaborated on. So, you know, and what's great about Darren is he's really good dramaturgically. So, you know, there's been a lot like we were really workshopping the play throughout the summer before The Fringe. So real kind of collaboration.
This is a play about grieving and about loss and about tough times. And it's taking place during First Fortnight as well, which is Ireland's annual Mental Health Arts and Culture Festival. So, Liam, what do you hope the audience is going to take away from it?
I suppose I hope that they engage. I hope that, you know, if you see something on that stage that reminds you of something in your own life, maybe you might be encouraged to do something about it, to take some kind of action, you know. Don't think theatre can change the world, but sometimes it can affect change, or, you know, to have a little bit of a conversation, and hopefully it's saying something for someone that might be going through. It's just great to be in a room and something live happening in front of you.
Yep. Darren York and Liam McCarthy, thanks for joining me tonight on the programme. He Dies in the End is at Smock Alley in Dublin from the 15th to the 17th of January as part of the First Fortnight Festival. And there's more details at firstfortnight.ie. Ned
comes, send word to all the ones who watch night disowned it.
It's David Keenan. That's called Postcards from Catalonia. And David is going to be playing live for us in studio tomorrow night here on Arena. There's lots going on tomorrow night's programme. We've also got Maggie O'Farrell talking to us about a small film you may have heard of called Hamnet, and taking it from the page to the big screen. And author Ronan Heshin tomorrow night on the endlessly fascinating time loop of Solveig Ball's novel series on the calculation of volume. We've got all of that tomorrow night from 7 o'clock here on Radio 1. Produced by Sinead Egan tonight, Paula Shields was our researcher. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator, and sound supervision tonight by Niall McMonagall. That's it for me, and I'll talk to you tomorrow night from 7 here on Radio 1.